Go. All right. Episode 47. We are back. The Capital Fortress. We're going to talk about the abandoned baby breakout maybe a little bit, but we've got a lot to talk about in a short amount of time. We're going to try to do this in an hour. We have got a crew here. I think there is a poly market on whether or not we get done in an hour. We'll see how fast we do this. Okay, I'll stop sharing my screen. Thank you, everybody. Welcome to episode 47 of True North, the Investment Grade Bitcoin Podcast. We are here. We are talking about Bitcoin. We are talking about financialization of Bitcoin. We're talking about securitization of Bitcoin and everything in between. We focus, you know, primarily on MSTR, but everything in the space. But MSTR is the clear leader here with 650,000 Bitcoin, and they are pioneering the path and creating the digital credit vehicle of the future. So tonight we've got myself, Mason, Adrian. Adrian hasn't been on a while. Mason haven't been on a while. So thanks for coming, guys. And then we've got Dan and Grain of Salt. And let's just jump right into it. Actually, real quick, let's hit this.
Ladies and gentlemen, what you're about to hear may be amazing, but it is not financial advice. It's for informational and educational purposes only. Jeff, back to you.
All right. Tim, crushing it. This is not financial advice. We are here having fun and talking about all of these things. So first of all, actually, I'm going to share my screen one more time. There are a couple exciting events on the horizon. The first one being Strategy World. This is in February of 2026. It's coming up very fast, February 23rd through February 26th. If you want to go to Strategy World, I went last year. I know many of the people on the screen went 2 years ago as well. And it is an incredible event. There's a lot of electricity there. You can hear, you know, you could be at the front end of what's happening in Bitcoin finance. It's like taking one of the Bitcoin conferences and just really focusing it on financialization of Bitcoin. They also have the it's really the AI business as well, that they've got, you know, tons of different panels and people talking about those things too. So if you want to learn more about the AI business and you want to learn more about the Bitcoin, it's a really interesting event. We do have a code. The code is True North with a capital T and a capital N. That'll get you 20% off at checkout. There you go. You can see it right there. And additionally, similar to last year, we are going to have a side event, an inside event at True North, or True North World, and it's going to be inside Strategy World. It will be on Monday, February 23rd. There will be 150 tickets. This will be very interactive, a little bit different than last year. We want this to be a chance for everybody to interact with all the folks of True North and other retail people, hoping to get a couple of guests as well. And last year, the strategy execs at Fong stopped by and had a quick talk as well. So a great chance to meet other people, talk about MSTR, really focused on MSTR and, you know, Bitcoin treasuries and everything happening in the space. So if you are interested in attending, please check it out. We will send the link in the chat. We will also post it after this. It is on Luma, True North Inside Event at Strategy World. We are going to have a really fun after party after this. So on Monday night, we are going to host, you know, drinks and food similar to what we did last year. And you do not have to have a ticket to Strategy World to attend True North World this year. And I think that's pretty much it. Anything else to add there, guys? You guys want to add some color on Strategy World event?
Oh, no, just go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, after last year, like last year's was, I thought, a smashing success. And we got a lot of time with everybody, perspectives and share opinions, I think, across the board. And I think this year it's going to be an even more flat format. So, like, I'm really excited to talk and discuss kind of how the last year's been for everyone. And especially considering we're not kind of going into price strength by any means this February, I think it'll be really interesting to see who's there and kind of who's weathering the storm and build some strong relationships out of it.
Yeah, zero Taurus.
Yeah, there's no tourists here.
Zero tourists. Yeah, hardcore, man.
The first 50 tickets cost two shares of Stretch, 2.1 shares of Stretch. The second 50 tickets cost 3.2 shares of Stretch, and the last 50 tickets cost 4.4 shares of Stretch. You can think of it that way. Or if you have on the preferred equities, maybe that makes sense.
Yeah, The first time we did True North World, it was a huge success, like Dan said. And for me, it was actually rather shocking meeting a lot of people that were so interested in actually meeting us and wanting to get to know us and whatnot and all the conversations. So I think it will be interesting to see, what, depending on the price action, where we're going to be at in February and the kind of people that we have showing up there. Like Nixon said, no tourists. So we should have more of a dedicated investor base, but I'm excited for it regardless. I think it should be really, really fun.
Cool. All right. It'll be a good time. We don't make money off this. Like we may make a little bit of money in sponsorships or something like that, but we're going to run this very thin. We want this to be a good time and exciting for everybody joining. So come hang out. It was really fun last year. It's great talking to people and not feeling like the crazy one, talking to my friends about Bitcoin and MSTR all the time. So cool. All right, let's jump into it. I will stop screen share here and we will shift gears. Okay. USD reserve. Big deal. Strategy just recently, over the last 8.75 days, sold $1.44 billion of common stock equity and have now built a cash USD reserve to effectively be there in case of emergency to pay dividends into the future. And they've dubbed this the battery for the digital credit vehicle. And there a few things are really fascinating here. To me, the things that jump out is instantly this reduces the risk profile of the preferreds drastically. Just psychologically, like it may not have changed the dynamics, but psychologically, that's a significant buffer there. They're going to have nearly 2 years of cash buffer to pay the dividends and can continue to operate this vehicle into perpetuity. With this cash buffer, they've got 71 years of payment based on the current price of Bitcoin. That's stable. That's incredibly stable. And the rating agencies will also start to see this cash reserve. They now have to give credit for the cash because it's real cash. It's not just Bitcoin. Previously, the credit rating agencies gave zero credit for the Bitcoin. Now they've got $1.44 billion of cash. So you can compare that to the liabilities or the obligations on the horizon. I've also, near the end, if we've got some time, I've got some credit framework thinking about CET bank scores in comparison to large, too big to fail banks. And we can compare like what a credit rating would look like if you gave, Bitcoin 30% credit or 20% credit. We can compare. So I'm going to kick it over to you guys. What do you guys think? I mean, this is big, right? There's a lot of noise, bears and bulls, both directions. And some people hate it. Some people love it. The Bitcoin maxis hate it, but the Bitcoin maxis generally didn't know what was going on to begin with. And and then there's the, small cohort of people that, can see both sides of the thing.
Yeah, I think the USD reserve is a pretty big deal. So kind of like what you said, this is the preferreds being able to scale is a confidence game. I think a lot of investors are going to want to know that the dividends will be paid. And the fact that Strategy took the step to establish that the reserve says that they're being very, very serious and very, very mindful of ensuring the dividends, at least for the next 12 to 24 months. And some people have even said that it somehow undermines the Bitcoin thesis because, you know, there is fiat and so on and so on and so forth. But I don't think it undermines the thesis. I think, in fact, it underwrites it, is the way I would frame it. The being able to guarantee the preferred dividends for the next two or so years gives investors confidence to say that I bought into Stretch, I bought into Strike, I bought into Strife, I bought into Stride. They might even do one for Stream, for all we know. And I know that my dividends are going to come to me for the next 12 to 24 months. That allows them to get to steady state, I think, a lot quicker. I think the market perception of them will change a lot quicker. I think that the reality of it is that a lot of Bitcoin maxis, as you say, hate this because they, you know, everything is fiat. Fiat is trash, so on and so on and so forth. But Strategy doesn't represent it represents the securitization of Bitcoin. It doesn't represent the Bitcoinization of a security. Strategy needs to exist in a market, in a capital market, and needs to be able to function in capital markets. And I think they're taking steps in order to make that happen with this USD reserve. And I think this would be good for forward-looking valuations. I think this will be good for credit ratings. I think this will be good for everything that they're trying to do, especially if we weather a downturn and they are able to still be paying out the dividends and they're able to maintain the dividend structure even in a bear market. Because that was one of the biggest criticisms, right? If Bitcoin if we have a big Bitcoin downturn, how are they going to pay for the dividends? I think they kind of just knocked that out immediately. And in my view, I think they should be building a cash reserve in perpetuity. Everything that they do going forward should be seen kind of holistically, in my view. It's not just about acquiring Bitcoin. It's about maintaining the capital structure in all market conditions. And I think that a USD reserve helps that. And given the fact that they've had something like, they've had over $1.17 trillion in trading volume year to date, I think that they have a lot of legway to be able to accumulate a cash position, even in a market downturn, and maintain the stability of the overall capital structure. Because I really do think that Strategy represents an economy, and people need to start seeing it that way versus just a smattering of offerings and equities. So I think it's good overall. That's just my view.
Yeah, if you look at the risk model that they published on their website, I'm just going to share it real quick. And this is based on the presentation. We can kind of roll through this a little bit with you guys. One thing that this risk model doesn't take into consideration is the cash reserve. So this is assuming a 45% BTC volatility and a 10% BTC ARR, but it doesn't assume utilizing the cash reserve before the Bitcoin kicks in, before having to sell the Bitcoin to kick in. So it's missing this component of stability of having the cash reserve buffer for 2 years. So it reduces the risk and pushes the credit spread even wider across the board. And you can take even more conservative figures. You could take 60% BTC volatility and 10% BTC ARR. And I think these would still look really attractive relative to other things in the market.
Well, Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, I think you're right, Jeff. And I think there is some sort of efficient frontier of the USD reserve relative to the Bitcoin reserve. Because if you take it to an extreme, if you were all USD, right, we get full credit for the USD on the balance sheet, but we wouldn't be growing the balance sheet at 30 ARR,
right,
as is laid out by the Bitcoin growth rate. So, like, I think they've probably done a lot of work behind the scenes to determine that, in fact, 2 years worth of dividend payments is kind of the optimal one's perspective as to strength of dividend payments to weather a bear market, but then also two, to maintain enough BTC on the balance sheet to have the volatility and potential returns to outpace the preferreds for the common holder. So they've probably spent a lot of time behind the scenes trying to figure out kind of what the optimal amount of USD reserve is, I think.
Funny enough, I almost disagree with you. I'm sure they've done it. I'm sure they've done a ton of work, but like,
you think they flubbered?
No. Not what I'm going for. Sailor probably felt comfortable with the existing business model, and you know, they raised $1.44 billion in cash in eight days. like 8 trading days. It proved the business model works. Like when Bitcoin was down, when Strategy stock price was down, yeah. Everything was hammered. Sentiment was horrible. The stock didn't even really move in those 8 days, and it was over a holiday. Like, and they raised.
I agree. I think something changed in the last. What I heard was that 2 weeks ago, this was not a consideration.
Yeah,
for Strategy.
Interesting.
But then, in the last 2 weeks, something changed.
I think it's also important to put 1.4 billion in perspective. Strategy's market cap, or MicroStrategy's market cap, was 5 billion in the bottom of 2022.
It might even be lower than
that. I think it was 4 or 5 billion, right? So it's absurd the amount of capital that they raise. And I think from my perspective, I think they're doing it for the skeptics, right? I think it's exactly right. Like Saylor was definitely happy with the business model, but I think institutional capital is skeptical. And what they're trying to do is season the asset, right? This is brand new. All these are brand new. These didn't exist this time last year, right? So that combined with the 4-year cycle FUD, which is definitely in the mind of institutions as well, right? 3 years up, 1 year down, then having 2 years of dividends. In their mind, if the 4-year cycle continues, and if Strategy falls below 1 mNAV, they're going to be able to pay regardless. And that's kind of the sentiment that I heard from Fong in his interview with the What Bitcoin Did channel. Was he said, we're going to pay the dividends, we're going to continue to do it, we're being tested right now, and we're going to show the market we are going to come out of this stronger.
Really good points, Mason. Yeah.
So kind of like what Jeff was saying about it proves the business model with the fact that they're able to raise the capital so quickly in the last in those 8 days or 8.5 days when sentiment was in the shitter. That in my mind was one of the most telling things for me, because you know the ATM has been something that people have belabored for a long time, and I've done a lot of analysis on the ATM to see if it actually is driving price. And the fact that they were able to do that, get the USD reserve established, get this out to the market, bring the signaling to the market, change the overall perspective of the preferred offerings, I think is a major win that people are kind of underestimating, because it shows that Strategy, the demand for it persists even in this downturn cycle. And the demand for these preferred offerings, I think, has been somewhat validated, because they must have seen the impetus to do it, right? If they thought this was something that was going to something that they're going to have to kind of trot along to make work, I don't know if they would have pulled the trigger on this at this point, especially with the market being where it's at. I believe that internally they probably, are seeing that there is persistent demand for the preferred offerings. I think the volume bears that out. And I think they see this as a major turning point for the preferreds, given the fact that they are not even the oldest one is what, Strike, and it's not even a year yet. I think it'll be a year in February 1st. So It really validates the model, and I think that this is going to be more respected and more be seen as a more effective form of capital allocation that they're doing as this goes on. So I still don't get the people that are FUDing the fact that they have a USD reserve. I don't get that angle, because they have to pay out the dividends in USD, so why wouldn't they have a USD reserve? But I think the market's just going to come around to it the more time goes on. And as the months go on, and as we go into year one and then year two and then year three and so on and so forth of the preferreds, I think that they're really going to scale. So I've become more excited about the perspective of the preferreds, given the fact that they've taken this step.
Yeah, the FUD has been just eviscerated.
It has been. I do have to say, if you're a complete Bitcoin maxi, then in fact, the USD reserve technically decreases your edge in the arbitraging the CAGR between BTC and USD. So I do understand why some people may be a little bit hesitant to adopt it, but from the perspective of it increases adoption of the preferreds, because the credit rating agencies and institutions are much more confident in Strategy's balance sheet now, I do think in the long term it is the best move. But I do also understand the Bitcoin maxi perspective of like, why are you ATMing to buy USD?
I'll take the opposite end of that just for conversation's sake. I've been in Bitcoin since 2012. I have been as toxic a maxi as possible for many, many years, until I would say the last three. Bitcoin, you buy Bitcoin using fiat. Bitcoin is priced in fiat. You are growing your nominal wealth in Bitcoin terms, but you're still pricing it in fiat. So people that are saying that the maximalist stance of we don't get why you're ATMing to get USD, I think that it's more of a philosophical stance than a practical one. So I understand that many think that cash is trash, fiat is trash, so on and so forth. But having this absolutist stance, even as someone that's been in Bitcoin for so long, it doesn't even make sense to me anymore. So I am of the mindset that I think people are just saying this to say it. They don't like what Saylor's doing, so therefore they're finding flaws in it no matter what he does.
So
Chris, I think that could be true. Yeah.
Chris mentioned something here that I was literally about to say, increase the torque. So I'm sure that they had a buyer that came to them and said, hey, if you guys had US dollars on your balance sheet, $2 billion worth, 2 years of reserve, we're going to buy, $5 billion, and it's like, I like this, but I'm a little sketched out. You're raising capital via the ATM. And, if you had a bunch of dollars and you could pay the dividends for a couple of years, maybe I'd be willing to take that risk. So while this was a short-term change in Bitcoin per share or exposure per share by, bringing in dollars in the door, there was an opportunity cost of not doing this. Right? If they wouldn't have done this, maybe that buyer would never buy. And so not only does it help with the ratings, not only does it help with the risk, it helps with opens capital doors. And I'm sure that this kicks open capital doors.
Yeah.
Right. Like the question.
I think you're completely right.
The question of like, how are you going to pay the dividends? And you say, well, I'm going to use the common stock ATM. It just sounds uncomfortable to most people. They don't. This is a new model, right? Like they can raise capital because their stock trades $3.6 billion a day. They only need to raise $2.2 billion a day on their common stock ATM. That I loved the presentation, how he walked through it. 6 bips of the daily trading volume. That's insane, right? They tapped the ATM for 4.5% of the daily trading volume for 8.5 days and raised $1.44 billion, and all they need to do is raise $2.2 million a day. I think they're going to be able to do it because you've got all of these algorithms that are running back and forth and trading the stock back and forth day to day. Like there's so much liquidity in the stock because it's powered by Bitcoin. Like that's one of the elements here of why you put Bitcoin on your balance sheet. It makes your stock attractive to all of these algorithms and everything that could go in between all of these instruments.
Yeah, Jeff, I think a big part of this was just a proof of concept, right? Let's raise $1.5 billion and stick in cash. Just let's demonstrate that to the market. Let's make them feel safe that we have the capital. And like you said, it's going to kick open doors for capital. Like if you're not, if you don't see the value in this, I'm not sure what else they could do.
Well, look at how commercial real estate.
That's what I'm saying. Some people just don't like it and they're not going to like it no matter what they do. And I think that's what we're seeing with a lot of the criticism. And to Jeff's point about the volume.
Honestly, we're going to get past the criticism in like 2 days. Like the FUD has disappeared. Like if you don't like it, you're gone anyway. Like you probably don't even hold the stock. And if you didn't like it and you sold that day, like the stock's already turned back around. And of course we've hit the, what is it called?
The abandoned baby
breakout. So, I'm just going to YOLO my life savings on that. And I'm just kidding.
This 1080.
So, yeah. I want to chime in real quick.
We're back.
I think they're going to go. Yeah. I think they're going to go to, closer to $3 billion. I think they're going to, cause Fong said, I re-listened to his short clip that came out. And then I said, it was like at 3:31, the clip that came out earlier today. And it says, hey, we may go to 2 to 3 years of having a cash reserve. And so I think that if they're going to start doing a lot of prefs, then I think that they're going to let this run. They're going to hit that. And so, look, folks, the math is really simple. Just use simple round numbers. If Bitcoin's 100,000 and they have 650,000 Bitcoin, that's $65 billion. 2% of $65 billion is $1.3 billion, right? What does that mean? $1.3 billion is pretty close to 1.44, which ended up being 21 months. So they only have to dilute the stock 2%. This year, they diluted the stock at 13%. And so what's going to happen is next year, they really don't have to hit the MSCR ATM unless the MNAV grows up and goes higher. And that's when they can when Sarah says he can arbitrage that difference, the delta between 1.0 and 1.25, 1.5 or 2.0. So I think what they've done here is I think they're going to expand this out to 2.5, 3 years. And as they increase the prefs that are outstanding, of course, the amount of months will drop down because they'll do more prefs next year. So I think that's what they have these different levers. You know, the key term back in, you know, there's always with CEOs, there's always like the flywheel effect or levers. Now they have multiple levers to pull. The MSCR ATM, they have the cash balance, they have the prefs. Did they say what they're going to do with that cash? Are they going to park it in treasuries?
I'm sure they're going to ladder it. I'm sure we will find out.
Sure.
And I'm sure that they will ladder it into, you know, different duration treasuries, just as like an insurance company would, right? Like if I don't need this, I'm going to park it in a certain place and let it sit there.
I think Gray, your point's really well taken, because think about it. Like, you know, we talked a lot about, and I don't think we've talked about it enough, the effects of amplification on the balance sheet. And so initially when they came out the press, I think the most exciting thing for me and a lot of investors was like, okay, they can go from having a 20% debt to leverage or debt to equity ratio to upping that to 30, 40, even 50% because this is permanent capital that doesn't have to get refinanced or paid back, right? Okay. So based on that, and now with the USD cash reserve, I think you could get institutional investors, especially high yield bond investors who may be interested in Stride, or maybe convertible investors interested in a product like Strike, structured Bitcoin. They may be comfortable with a higher leverage ratio, maybe 40. And if you believe in Bitcoin's CAGR over the next 10 years, this is where the stock gets interesting. If you enter at around a 1 MNAV and they're able to maintain a sustainable 30, 40, 50% debt to equity ratio via the prefs, your outperformance relative to Bitcoin is extremely substantial, like very substantial. So that leverage ratio, in my opinion, and that's what I've said from the beginning, I feel like is like the leverage ratio is everything for Bitcoin treasury. And if this enables them a higher leverage ratio, this is the kind of the golden goose in terms of Bitcoin outperformance over the next 10 years.
Yeah, 100%. And you, the crazy thing is the math works. if you have 2 to 3 years of dividend reserve, you can crank the leverage ratio higher. I've been running just several simulations on the back end, using Monte Carlo sims and different models and different, you know, price paths, etc. And it's crazy. If you don't have to sell any of the Bitcoin, you could probably go at like 100% leverage or 100% amplification, and the math still works. Like it
which is insane.
You look at 100% amplification, you're like, well, actually the math still works.
Well, and that's like the insurance company model, right? Or like, exactly. Well, what they've been saying about now is like, you know, we could lend out our reserves. And that's what I was so interested about strategy from the beginning is like right now, the way they're structuring their Bitcoin yield, right? Via ATM issuance at a premium, arbitraging the MNAV, and then plus the leverage while Bitcoin increases, which increases their Bitcoin per share over time as the leverage melts or as the pref dividends melt relative to the Bitcoin carrier. That is all diminishing Bitcoin yield over time. Unfortunately, that's just the nature of the math. But if you were able to lend out the Bitcoin at 4 or 5% through a bulge bracket bank in sort of a safe manner, that's exponential Bitcoin yield. And now you can put real price to earnings ratios on the amount of Bitcoin yield that they're creating inside their capital structure. So I think in terms of the argument for higher and higher MNAVs, if they can get to that exponential Bitcoin yield, like game's over, they've won.
Yeah. One other thing, I think Emperor said this as well, and I completely agree with it, is I think the likelihood that they touch this cash reserve is very low. I think that there's a high likelihood that it's business as usual, unless we see, you know, like catastrophic movement in, you know, equity market and Bitcoin market all at once in a correlated fashion. Otherwise, I wouldn't be surprised if they actually don't use the common stock ATM very much anymore for capital, because they've got plenty of capital and they use it just to pay the dividends, and they've got the USD cash reserve, and then they just sell the absolute shit out of the preferreds. And, you know, all of the business models, you go to insurance companies, you go everywhere and you try to, you really push on the rating agencies to give you something, something greater than B minus, and rate each individual product. Like, they've got an issuer credit rating, which is great, but each product itself isn't rated. So once the products themselves get rated, that's another, you know, kick the door open. There's capital coming in the door.
I think you're right. I think that they're going to get to, like I said, I think it's going to be a 2 to 3 year cash buffer, and they're going to just be able to ATM in order to pay that. Because like I said, if we get some help from Bitcoin at 100,000, that's $65 billion at 2% to raise $1.3 billion, which they don't need because it's only $800 million per year right now. The number is going to grow, but they only need so much each quarter. So you divide 2% out by each quarter, right? And then it ends up being 0.5% of what they have to sell, which is a small number. So you did the calculation. What was your calculation, Jeff, on how many Bitcoins you think they're going to add next year? I had a number.
Oh, should we go back to our guesses from earlier this year? Because I think Dan has like nailed it on the head.
I think I nailed it.
I think he nailed it on the head.
I think I got it on the T, unfortunately. Yeah. Unless they come out with a crazy preferred between the Canadian preferred between now and the end of the year.
Yeah, I'll have to find.
Well, what do you guys think it's going to be for next year, though? You think they're going to add 100,000 Bitcoins next year?
I think they will, Grant. I think they will.
I think they'll add 100,000 Bitcoin. Yeah.
I don't think they'll add more than that, but I think they will. Because I think the price of Bitcoin will be higher by the end of 2016.
My simulation came in between 85,000 and 100,000, and it really depended upon, you know, how much help they get from Bitcoin itself. If Bitcoin trades sideways, it'd be 85,000. If Bitcoin went up, then I think that, and if it goes up, you assume that there'd be volatility with it, that my simulations came in 85 on the low side, 100,000 on the high side.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Which is a monster war chest of Bitcoin.
He just absolutely enormous. I think it could be higher, like 150K. 25% BTC yield would be 150K, and that would be just pure yield over and above.
Yield, not addition, not treasury assets, but per share.
Right.
I think they have to come up with somehow to explain, like we were saying in the beginning of the call, that if they have this cash buffer, how does it change their credit spreads? Because now all of a sudden it takes that risk off the table for the next 21 months or 24
I'm
months
working
or
36. On it.
Oh, you're working on that?
I'm working on it. Yeah. It's tricky. It's tricky, like, when you put it in the sim. But yeah, I'm working on it.
I did want to talk about.
Go
ahead. Yeah, this.
No,
this,
Grant,
this,
go ahead.
Yeah, so I had talked about this, and I want to go to EPS for a second. So when they did the revised, and I published this on December 2nd, well, that was yesterday, I guess. I published this that what was missing in the document, they had two targets. They had one at 85,000 and one at 110,000. And so 85,000 was their new bear case scenario, that what happens if on December 31st it was 85,000, that they would have a net loss for the year. And then at 110 means that the Q4 would be positive. So I was like, what's the over under? And so we calculated that, and the over under is, if Bitcoin is 97,000 or higher on December 31st, the whole year has positive EPS. Okay. If they hit 110,000, Q4 is positive EPS, and then they'll make $19 a year. So if it's like 98,000, the EPS is going to be really small for the year because Q4 is going to be a negative. But if it 110, these are your two numbers, 97,000 and 110,000 on December 31st. And I think that's, you know, people like football or, you know, professional sports, that's the over under is 97,000. And I'd prefer it to be at 110.
Grain, Bitcoin's working for you right now. So
it's working. Well, what are we at? 94?
Just under, I think.
94?
93 and a half. I'm blowing up the price chart.
You know, the other part, I want to bring up one last part on the prefs, and this is something that people always, they seem to overlook this. So Saylor uses the term digital credit. The prefs are, even though they're an equity, perpetual prefs, even though that's what they are, right, in an equity wrapper, they're actually classified as credit. So when they issue these prefs, it does not increase the outstanding shares for the MSTR. When I say MSTR, I mean the MSTR stock. And when I say the prefs, it's STRK, F, C, D. And so for those, it does not change the outstanding shares on MSTR. That's why it's non-dilutive. This is where people miss this part. I've talked to some really, really smart people. They're like, well, it's in an equity wrapper. I go, yeah, but it's classified as credit. That's why if you look up on the website, it says credit. It does not dilute the MSTR shareholder. There's an obligation that has to be paid, which is the yield. That's why they established, we talked all for 35 minutes about the cash buffer. But that's why if they hammer the prefs, that's why the amplification goes up, because it's not diluting the MSTR.
And the reason...
Go on.
Exactly. And that's so, so attractive for a Bitcoin bull or a maxi, right? Because in your brokerage account, what can you construct of like a Bitcoin ETF sort of situation, right? You can have like, okay, maybe you can have 30% debt to leverage, debt to equity in your brokerage account using like a bit, but you have a margin call provision and that can change on a daily basis. So what Saylor says is like, what's a margin loan? It's 1 week money, right? What are the prefs? They're permanent capital for strategy. So if they can up their amplification to say 40%, they will effectively have a better credit stack or leverage Bitcoin stack than anyone can create in any margin account.
Any form. In any form.
Yeah. And so that becomes an extremely attractive wrapper for Bitcoin maxis, for everyone.
And it's not like, and people say, well, you could just buy, you know, 2x leverage Bitcoin ETF. And it's like, well, that's 2x leverage on the daily.
Yeah, it's completely different. Right? Exactly.
2x leverage on the daily. And that, like, that's not 2x leverage like annually. It's 2x leverage on the daily. So that is not an instrument to hold long term into the future. Like it's going to, if the price of Bitcoin goes down, you know, $10, it's going to go down $20, and then you now have to go back up even higher. It's going to have decay over time as a leverage instrument. It's like a short term thing. So like, if you want amplified Bitcoin exposure, you buy amplified Bitcoin equities
with permanent Bitcoin, right? You know exactly what you're paying at 10% a year. That's my dividend obligation as an MSTR common holder to the pref holders. Okay. 10% a year. I have the Bitcoin. Now all I have to bet on is the Bitcoin appreciating faster than the obligations which I owe to the pref holders, and I retain that as Bitcoin per share in the common. It's a very simple kind of formula, and they set it up such that it's permanent and you have no decay over time other than the pref drag.
Yeah, as Saylor said, it's the law of thermodynamics. You have like the excess volatility and it all goes to the common.
I just want to say something. They've done everything. They've got tables. They've got the website on strategy.com. They've got every table, every number you could want. They tell you the leverage ratio, net leverage, BTC years, right? They tell you that it's 74.8 years, 21 months in USD reserve. So they tell in every single table imaginable, right? They have the credit, shares outstanding, all this is listed, every single purchase of Bitcoin they've done over the past 5 years. So all this information on the website. Then they actually do it in a presentation with bar charts, and they got this really cool rocket ship that's got a height, and they say that the cash reserve is the freaking battery, right? And it's like,
I loved it.
Right. Yeah. So then they have this figurative reason how this works. And somebody is like, you know, there it is. And so somebody is like, no, everything should be an electric car. Well, you know, maybe I don't want to charge a car and drive to LA, you know, from where I live. And you don't want to stop to do it. You just want to stop for gas and go, and you don't want to do it. So what's better, an all gas car, a hybrid car, an electric car? Some people have an electric car and some people have a hybrid or a gas car. They have two different vehicles, right? And so when you see something like this, people are like, he's doing these fancy drawings. I'm like, what else do you want the dude to do? I'm like, and then you go up two slides, go to slide 10.
Yeah. Oh,
Yeah, right. And then they got the table. Right. And then they got this. Oh, that's too complex. It's like, you know what? Give me a break. I mean,
It's pretty ironic. People criticizing the drawing and then not understanding it.
You know, there's a bar chart. If you go up showing the, what's the one where they have the huge bar and a really small, oh, you're right there. 7.
Yeah. The relativity, the reserve right. relative to dividends.
Well, they're like, that doesn't make sense. Show me the picture. And then they show the picture and you're like, ah, I don't like the picture. It seems like
too many memes. Too many memes.
And then they do all the math for you. 74 years of dividend coverage and 1.3. Right. They need Bitcoin to go up by 1.35. And I love the escape velocity, cruise speed, stall speed.
Yeah, the BTC stall speed was an interesting one to think about, where Bitcoin's got to go down 19% compounded annually for 10 years in a row in order for the business model to in order for the assets to be worth the value of the dividends the value of the notional outstanding.
This is crazy. I saw somebody had said on X, well, if Bitcoin goes to 10,400, then Saylor is screwed. I want to tell you something. If Bitcoin goes to 10,400, which I really hope it never does, and you get people always like, oh, I would just go buy as much as I can. I'll tell you right now, the world will be a miserable place. Not Bitcoin. Yeah. The whole world will be a miserable place if Bitcoin drops down to 10,400, right? To have a 90% drop from here, I think that you will wish that did not happen. So
I think you're right, Green. What will NVIDIA be at if Bitcoin goes down to 10,400?
It'd be like 40 bucks.
NVIDIA, yeah, Bitcoin is a macro asset now. So dropping down that far, it says that there's far more issues going on globally and macroeconomically. So that scenario, everyone's fucked.
But I think there's $2 trillion of capital stored in it.
Yeah. So I coming back to what I said, what's going on is that people are falling into a few camps right now. One, it's a Ponzi scheme no matter what Saylor does. They're going to say Ponzi, 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 Ponzi because they don't like what he's doing. So that's that camp. And the other camp is
they missed it.
Yeah. The other camp is people that missed it or that are pissed off for whatever reason that they have a group of individuals that were in this equity that others that they missed. Then I think the final camp is just that I don't want to call them the doomers, but there's, especially with what's been going on in the markets right now, there's a growing sense of people that want to see the market crash.
Yeah.
To be the ones that say, I told you so. Bitcoin's overvalued. NVIDIA's overvalued. Palantir's everything's overvalued. Needs to crash. Blah, 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 blah. I think that's what we're seeing a lot of the loudest voices are. So at this point, strategy can do whatever they can, but they're not going to change anyone's mind. So I think the path is forward. And I think that's what we're doing here. And I think that's what they're trying to do. And it's just weird what's going on, man. No matter everything that they come up with in terms of FUD, strategy finds a way to address it. And then either the goalpost gets shifted or people don't like what they did to address it. Or like Green said, they don't like the graphic, or they don't like the table, or they don't like whatever. I think we need to accept that they just don't like it.
Yeah. And the institutional sentiment is not what you see on X.
Like, not even remotely close.
I think that's X just one of the biggest takeaways. Yeah. It's just like, there's so many people working behind the scenes on this stuff. And there's so much you don't see everywhere else. And those doomers are the same ones that are waiting for house prices to crash. Right. It's like, okay, if house prices crash, do you have your job still? You know, like, is that a place you want to be?
Jeff, yeah, I think a lot of these people waiting for the crash fundamentally don't understand that we're in an inflationary system that at this point is requiring all assets to go up over time in a pretty steady manner in order to stay afloat and to keep functioning. So if we do get a 10K, 15K, even 20K Bitcoin in some kind of crash, maybe like we saw with COVID, I think we'll see massive amounts of liquidity and which will lead to a melt up. And I think a melt up is far more likely in the next 3 to 5 years or so. And honestly, it's more painful for the average person. You know, with a crash, at least everyone, you know, the people who have nothing still have nothing, right? With the melt up, the rich get richer, and the K-shaped economy widens. And that's kind of the mechanism that we've been seeing in our current inflationary system, in which asset prices go up with inflation, goods go up as well, wages stagnate, rich get richer, and the poor or the working class get left behind.
Yeah, 100%.
Well, I think owning assets is pretty much, yeah, the owning assets is pretty much going to be the only way that people are going to get ahead. And I honestly do think that if you use a real estate example, people that are waiting for the real estate crash, for instance, like you said, Jeff, do you still have your job? That's one thing they don't think about. Another thing they don't think about is, while you're looking over here waiting for this to fail, what other opportunities are you missing over here? AI has turned into a secular trade. Bitcoin is turning into a secular has been a secular movement that's slowly becoming more and more ingrained into corporate and institutional structures. While you're waiting for everyone to fail to be able to point at them and say that I told you so, you can very likely find yourself in a position in 1, 3, 5 years where everything, asset prices have gone up, even if we do see a massive correction or crash, and you're still left holding nothing. So it may be more of a beneficial use of time if people find ways to invest where they can or find ways to advance where they can, because the government's not going to help you. And we're kind of all being left on our own to figure things out. And like groups like this and other groups that exist online are kind of grassroots in that way, where it's everyday individual people that are trying to figure this thing out as they go along, which is what Strategy is doing. They're figuring this out as they go along, which is why there have been bumps in the road. But again, some people just don't like it, and we're going to see what's going to happen with it. I think it's going to be successful. I think that the USD reserve is a huge move. I think that they've given themselves an impressive runway for at least the next 1 to 2 years. And I think this is where things get really interesting, especially where bank custody comes into play, where the whole calculus of the entire system becomes different. I really think that Strategy is on the cusp of having, I'm not going to call it like a price breakout or anything like that, but hitting a point of steady state stability. Phase one was kind of announcing the Bitcoin treasury plan. I think phase two is the preferred, so what we're seeing right now. And I think phase three is going to be where things get really interesting.
We're headed there. I've got to show the estimates, because we actually have a race here and it's pretty close. So Adrian, you're right on the nose right now. If Strategy doesn't purchase any more Bitcoin, you are the winner, the closest to the pin winner. 650,000 Bitcoin. Ironically, if they would have bought Bitcoin with $1.44 billion, they would have 665,000 Bitcoin. So it's a fight. We'll see how many more Bitcoin are purchased in the next couple of weeks here, leading up to the end of the year. But my money is probably on Ben. Getting a little bit closer on this one.
I think Gladiator was too bullish.
Yeah.
Gladiator was very bullish. I was very bullish myself.
Well, because the God candles were loading, and that's why he had a bigger number.
Yeah. Doubled.
They were loading. Yeah, and we were going to be able to instantly ATM the stock every week. That's what I was figuring.
Yeah. I think all of our expectations for what Bitcoin was going to do, and then hence Strategy stock, was probably overextended at that point.
I think so. Right. I think so.
Yeah, absolutely. We did this on 12/31. And then they had 446,000 Bitcoin at the time. I mean, that's pretty crazy. Like Adrian being right on the nose at 650 and Ben being on the
also, we had like 2 minutes to calculate this. Like not
we
even.
Did. Yeah.
Like,
it was, like, it was live, like, on the show.
I think, New Year's, everyone's going to start doing calculus from this point to try to get closest to the pin for next year.
I might hold 888 for 26.
Yeah.
be the bull for 26. Okay. I want to show one more thing. We're coming up on 49 minutes here. So I pulled up, I had a listener send me some information on CET ratios, and I thought these are interesting. So these are like, shock ratios. So the Federal Reserve sets each large U.S. bank's CET1 requirement at the sum of 4.5%. So what I've pulled here from Perplexity is current CET1 ratios on the largest banks in the world: TD Bank, Nordea Bank, JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, etc. And they have these CET ratios in the around, like, you know, 15, 16%. So large, too big to fail banks, large international banks have roughly 13 to 14% CET ratios. This is like, this is to show effectively how good your bank is at weathering shocks in the system. So if you have a higher percentage here, that means you've got effectively more liquid assets. You're a safer entity if you have a higher percentage. That's why the Federal Reserve sets the large bank CET requirement at 4.5%. Now, what I wanted to do is back into, like, you know, what if Basel gave credit for Bitcoin? What would that number need to be? What would the credit for Bitcoin need to be in order for Strategy to have a similar CET1 ratio? Which is interesting. It's an interesting exercise. So a CET1 ratio, if you gave 26% credit for the Bitcoin on the balance sheet, so effectively the $60 billion worth of Bitcoin held on the balance sheet is worth $15.8 billion from this solvency, from the solvency perspective, you'd have a CET1 ratio on an as-if basis of 7.2%. So you would be, you know, within the target that the Federal Reserve sets for US, large U.S. banks. And this is including the USD reserve of $1.4 billion. Without the USD reserve of $1.4 billion, these metrics change quite a bit because the denominator, the numerator and the denominator take into consideration your liquid, like, USD assets. So the numerator is common equity equals assets minus debt minus the preferred notional. So you get to a numerator of $1.2 billion here in this exercise. And the denominator is your Bitcoin on a markdown basis and then the USD reserve. So $17.3 billion. One thing that's really interesting here, so if you change this to 30%, your CET1 ratio on an as-if basis is 18.6%. So that would be better than any of the largest international banks on the planet. And it doesn't seem outlandish to give 30% credit for the Bitcoin on the balance sheet. So that's equivalent to saying, you know, in a shock scenario, would you be able to liquidate 650,000 Bitcoin for a price, an average price of $28,000?
I think we could comfortably say that would likely be the case.
That would likely be the case.
And Grant, what do they value your crypto assets, so like any sort of MSTR or Bitcoin, at when looking at your creditworthiness? For like
when they looked at me, they valued it at 50%. And I think one of the parts that drives me nuts about this is that the Basel rules. So that is valued at a bank needs to have 8%, and then they can do 12.5 to 1 leverage and lend out the rest. That's the Basel rules. And then Bitcoin is 1200. It has a volatility rate of 1250%. So it makes it horrendous. You just really can't have it on the balance sheet the way the Basel rules look at it. But the comical part about this is that I believe it was in 2020 or 2022, the Fed said U.S. banks can keep zero in on their balance sheet and lend out everything 100%. So it Basel says 8%, which is 12.5 to 1 leverage. And guys, this is the reason why this is so hard for people to understand. Strategy has 11% debt on their website. That means they have 89% total equity, right? Basel is the exact opposite. It's on MSTR. Net leverage is 11%. Strategy is the opposite. That means they have 89% that they're holding. That's the equity part of this, meaning the after you strip away that debt, they're left with the remaining amount, which is 89%. But everybody else is the reverse. Yeah. In Basel rules, you only need to have 8% of the good stuff. The rest of it could be thin air. And then people are like, oh, well, Strategy is leveraged to the hilt. And I'm like, no, the numbers are too close. So people think they're the same and they're not. I don't know how this doesn't get through to people. Oh, Strategy's levered way up on this. No, he's not. If anything, he's the exact opposite of what the Basel rules are. I never heard of the set one rules are here. But we're in backwards world because we have the good stuff and people are like, oh, I'm just going to call you a Ponzi because I don't have time to listen and figure out what's going on.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. It's, yeah, you see a lot of these like, oh, it shows you how fragile the structure is. And you're like, well, actually, the math is showing that they're probably one of the strongest companies on the planet. Like, if you try to put them in a similar framework of any of these banks or any of these other institutions, and even just looking at this, right, like TD Bank has a 16.6% CET ratio. So, and they have an S&P issuer credit rating of A.
So, one of the things that came back when I was researching, I just happened to be researching this yesterday because I was on a space, and Joe Carlos like rightfully called me out because on Basel rules, I said that Bitcoin is valued at zero. He's like, no, it isn't. It's a tier two asset and it's valued at 1250%, you know, volatility. Well, in effect, you just can't have
that's zero. That's zero.
In effect, it's zero. But anyway, so when I was just looking at
1250%,
right, volatility, and so therefore no bank's going to have this. And it's so then I did some research on this, and I was going to bring up some other point about this, but I was like, this is absurd. I don't know how we explain this to people anymore. We tried everything.
You just got to do the math.
Part of the problem for me is I think it's because of how Bitcoin is still perceived. We are coming at it from a perspective of individuals that believe that Bitcoin is a pristine asset, believe that it's going to be the future asset of the world, so on and so on and so forth. The world isn't there yet. So I think with a lot of this, it's not just an education thing, it's a perception thing. And as Bitcoin becomes more stable and it becomes more of the market cap grows and the price goes up and it becomes far more ingrained into market structures, that perception will change. I don't know if this is a matter of education. I think it's a matter of perception and what people think and feel around Bitcoin. So as the sentiment around Bitcoin changes, a lot of the challenges that we're seeing right now with a lot of the ways that it's valued and viewed will change as well.
Adrian, I completely agree with that. And that's kind of the takeaway that I've been thinking about this past year, right? We saw Bitcoin go to 125. We saw BlackRock, or that was last year, but you know, BlackRock's largest source of revenue is the Bitcoin ETF. We're seeing pretty broad, I guess, beginning stages of acceptance of Bitcoin as a genuine asset. And I think it's going to take 10 years to really change the sentiment of the past 10 years, right? Think about how Bitcoin was reported on for the past 10 years, kind of the programming or the narratives that have been spread, bad for the environment, volatile, scams, all these coming from Jamie Dimon, Larry Fink, all these figures which are prominent and well-respected in the traditional finance realm. And I really think sentiment is it's going to take a while to turn it around. It's a tugboat, or not a tugboat,
it's like a
cruise ship.
Yeah, you see,
big ship.
You know what, guys? You see, I don't think it gets fixed, and I think what's going to happen here is you're going to have a group of people. I've said this before. If you if you realize that you have to buy assets, whether it's a house, Mag 7 stocks, Bitcoin treasury companies, you buy that, you have assets. We believe in the debasement trade. And the AI is a debasement of human capital, because a robot can do is just as effective as 10 people. And so what's going to happen is that the people that prepare themselves will be in great shape. And those people will love life, and that'll be utopia. And for the people that are like, the rich just got richer and they just don't want to see this. Oh, this is what I was going to say before. As soon as somebody says to me, I wish house prices would crash so I could buy a house. I go, well, the internet bubble basically burst in 2001. You could have bought a house then. Then there was a crash in 2009. You could have bought houses then because, you know, you had the great financial crisis. Nobody could sell their houses. And there were, you know, they had loan modifications and you could go buy these houses. And you can get them, you know, out of bankruptcy and whatever, right? And so they had that, go buy. Well, I guess you couldn't buy it then. And then they're like, oh, well, we need to have a reset. Well, I think we had a reset in 2020 with low interest rates. And people didn't, at that point, nobody was really moving because of COVID, but you had low interest rates. That was the prime time to buy a house because they printed the crap out of the money. You didn't want to wait till 2022 when inflation kicked in, right? And then you had the inflation go in. So then, you know, when do you want to buy a house? It's like you had these three opportunities. You never jumped on it. So when I just hear that, I just immediately discount those people immediately. So I think you're going to end up with two groups of people. People that did the homework, they did the work, they listened to a space, bunch of people talking about artificial money, artificial intelligence. Those people love life. And every day they're like, wow, this is awesome. I can't wait to see what Bitcoin goes to or what chip NVIDIA comes out with. Right. Yeah. And those people will be like, this is great.
Well, I think so I would agree with that, but there's a little bit of nuance because I couldn't have bought a house in 2000. I was a little bit young at the time. And
That's the problem.
So I think there's a generational factor here, which is valid. So I think that you have a lot of, so I'm a millennial, you have the Zoomers, you have we're the cohort that you hear a lot from that just doesn't like the way things are going, but you also have older individuals like Gen X and boomers that are saying the things that Grain is saying, right? But to Grain's point, they did have the opportunities. The problem is they couldn't capitalize on opportunity then because they were not in position to do so. So now in their mind, they're just seeing it all over again for a whole different set of reasons. I think it's not fair to assume that it's just, you're not smart, you're not working hard, you're not paying attention.
Let me clarify this. So I totally get what you're saying about the generational cohorts. What I'm saying is if you're 25 years old, this is not financial advice, but if you're listening to this 25 years old, then you probably think I want to buy a house in 5 years, you know, and you're going to 10 years, whatever the number is, right? You want to start a family and do that, not have to worry about paying rent and build equity, have a place to live because you like the community, whatever it is, or the weather. And what happens is you have to invest your money in some form of assets. You can't do it just on your job alone. And so then how are you going to divide up those assets into those investments? And I think the two biggest trades right now are artificial intelligence and artificial money. And so from there, if you want, where do you want to be in 5 or 10 years? Well, I think that I would probably want to invest in those Mag7 companies or, you know, Strategy or Bitcoin. And that will get you to buying a house down the road. And if you don't want to buy a house, don't buy one.
Grain,
where's the money going to come from? I'm not trying to make excuses for people. I'm just trying to get perspective. Where's the money going to come from? College tuition is out of control and it has been for about a decade.
Agreed.
So if you are a person that was not born into an upper middle class family and you had to take out student loans like I did, are you going to be someone that's going to work 4 jobs like I did? Because I've been everything from a bouncer at a bar to a janitor to a security guard while working as an analyst. Not everyone is cut out for that because this is the reason why I don't have children right now. It's the reason why I'm not married right now. There's cost benefit to everything. So the reality of it is that it's not just about making the investment. It's about being positioned to do so and doing what you need to do to position yourself. And that requires a lot of sacrifice for a lot of people. So for many people, depending on how they were raised, family is important. They want to have family. They want to have a house. They want to have all this other stuff. So they focus on that. They have a job, but they're not focused on it in the sense of this job is going to be what I do to pay the bills. I'm going to have another job to make investments. Then I'm going to have another job to make sure that I have something for a rainy day. Everything is a cost-benefit analysis in life. And not everyone is positioned to make the same cost-benefit analyses. So what you're saying is valid. I'm not saying that it's not. But what I'm trying to put across is, as someone that deals with individuals that are much younger than me on a daily basis, I'm still hearing the same story from all these younger developers. They went to college, but they have tons and tons of debt. They're making 150 grand a year, but they still can't pay their student loans.
Yeah.
I'll say one thing.
We can move on. I'll say one thing. So look, my net worth was zero at age 33. In 2000, I'm 58. I guess the math works out. So in 2000, when I got to Silicon Valley, my net worth was zero. And I did not get married until I was 37 years old. So what happened is I did exactly what you just said there. It was miserable. I lived in a crappy apartment, a one-bedroom apartment that I was able to go to work for it. And what did I do? When I got the first great job during, you know, right after, started in the internet bubble in in 1997. And once I did that, I was able to build up and save money and get ahead. And I did not get married. I did not get kids. And I did not own a house. I did not own a house until 2005. So I was already like 35 years old before I bought my first house. I did not get my first house when I was 25 years old. That did not happen. So I worked my ass off for 10 years. And to be honest with you, you know, given that it's kind of weird because at that point I was like, I just had to do it. That's just the way it was.
But that works for you. That works for me. But what I'm trying to say is for a lot of people, for most people, that decision is not as straightforward.
I totally agree.
Yeah.
So it's really hard.
There's a lot that goes into it.
I think a lot
of this is the fact that we've been kind of living in a reality where, like Rain just pointed out, the world is shifting, but the narrative is not shifting with it. And what's happening right now is that there's a wide disconnect between what people are being told is reality and what actually is happening. AI is happening. Bitcoin is happening.
Yeah.
And to us, it makes sense because we're in it. But what I'm trying to tell you is that there are a lot of people that I know that are highly intelligent, highly educated, should know this, that are completely blind to it.
It's the millennials dilemma. You've got all of these millennials now are approaching their highest earning years in their life, right? They're like mid 30s, early 40s, and they're coming up to the point of, what do I do with my money? Like, I'm making money. And I'm making money. I can't buy a house because I can't afford it. So if I can't buy a house, I need to put my money somewhere else. I can't hold cash. That's just clearly not working. I'm not making money fast enough. So I got to go put it somewhere else. And it's like, all right, well, maybe I had all my money in the S&P 500 over the last decade, and that's not going anywhere. I like don't feel any richer. Like $250,000 in your 401k at age 35, like that's still just not that much money anymore. All right. So then, okay, what do I do? Do I go buy Mag7? And you're like, well, these are already the most valuable companies in the entire market. This seems kind of risky. Like, I wish I could have bought Apple when I was born, but I can't. I can't go back and buy Apple. So, all right, now, like, I'm not going to buy bonds because those are for boomers. Like, those look horrible. Like, that's underperforming the S&P 500. And then you look at like AI. Okay, AI looks really interesting. Bitcoin looks really interesting. It's like, it's what's left. And the people that are leaning into AI and using AI and learning from AI very quickly are going to succeed here because they can use math very quickly. Like, if you go talk to most people, Grain, like you live in Silicon Valley, you're at the front end, you know what's going on in AI. But like my father-in-law came over for Thanksgiving and he's not using any LLMs. he's getting to retirement and like, I'm like, oh, just throw it in ChatGPT. He's like, no. He's like, so people that are using this stuff are going to run circles around everybody else that's not.
Yeah, Jeff.
That's what I'm saying. Like for me, I love it. It's working to my advantage right now because I have tripled my output. And sorry, didn't mean to cut you off, Mason. But that's the thing. In the past, socioeconomic power was cascading at the top, and now I think what's going on is that it's productive power that's cascading at the top as well with AI, and so it's creating a different kind of bifurcation in the market. And what you just said is very, very true because there's several very successful individuals that are executives that I have to report to, give reports to, give project plans to, so on and so forth. They don't use LLMs, but they're making $500,000 a year.
Yeah.
They're going to run into a wall here pretty hard in the next 2 years, I think. And that's going to be very, very disruptive. And then what happens? It's great for me. I'm going to land on my feet because I've been neck deep in this since ChatGPT came out. But just like Grain said, he works. He didn't buy a house. He didn't have kids. He didn't get married. He did all that stuff. Okay, that's great. But that's us.
Wait a second. Wait, I did get married. Did have? I did all.
No,
that.
I know. But, no, yeah, I'm, yeah, but it was you're talking about. I'm talking about when you were coming up, yeah. Right? So yeah, you delayed things a little bit. But so it's just very, very strange for me to see that this is kind of affecting everything across all socioeconomic groups. You have people that are very successful that don't know what's coming. You have people that are trying to make it that don't know what's coming. And it's not just Bitcoin anymore. It's also AI, and they're kind of converging. And it's going to be really, really interesting to see. Not in a good way, but.
Yeah. First off, Grain, I know you're not a boomer. Grain, you're not a boomer. And I did not refer to you as a boomer. Second, I'm going to pass the mic over to Mason because he's been trying to jump in there. Let Mason give us some wisdom.
Yeah, I think what we're talking about is the money's fundamentally broken, right? People feel like they're falling behind because their time and energy, their money, their time and energy in an abstracted form is literally being siphoned away from them. And that's what Bitcoin fixes, is that instead of having to research, instead of your father-in-law having to research AI stocks with ChatGPT or Grok or Gemini, like the layman doesn't want to do that. And that's what Bitcoin provides. It's a long-term viable solution for everyone's problem, which is how do you keep your money? And it's long-term in that it's sustainable. You can do it for 50 years. You can do it for 100 years. You buy Bitcoin and you hold it, and you either sell it or you spend it when you need that capital in the future. And I think what Strategy represents is a bridge between, what people are not necessarily comfortable with holding Bitcoin. That's what the preferreds are. And then what the common is to me is investing in a Bitcoin denominated world, right?
Yeah.
I think we are investors who have a framework, which Bitcoin is the hurdle rate. And in my mind, there's only two ways to do that. It's either invest in treasury companies, which are doing this essentially arbitrage, short fiat, long Bitcoin, or it's some version of Bitcoin venture capital, which you are investing in businesses that are building out the infrastructure of Bitcoin and are accumulating Bitcoin. So their Bitcoin per share or their Bitcoin stack is growing. And other than that, I don't know how you outperform in a sustainable way. I see a lot of people trading. I think they'll get wrecked.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's why I'm a Bitcoin advocate.
I think one of the really interesting things about Bitcoin and Strategy and these Bitcoin equities is this is the first time ever myself like trading in the equity market where I felt like doing the math has given me alpha. Like you can't do the math on like how many chips NVIDIA is going to sell. You hope, right? Like you take a structural bet on like how society is shifting and moving, and like how many cars is Tesla going to sell, right? Like, you've got all these metrics that will tell you pretty much nothing because you can't compare anything to anything else in the rest of the market. So you've got like all of these things that, people say that they use for relativities in different sectors and stuff. But like at the end of the day, the alpha here is that if you do the math on this stuff, if you do the math on Bitcoin, right? Bitcoin is a math problem, right? Like it itself, like Bitcoin is math money, it's physics money, and it's a relativity. You think of like the relative size of like the population and how many there are, and you take assumptions on probability curves of adoption and all of these things, and you can actually run this math and front run it, but you can't do that in really anything else. So it's been really appealing to me from that perspective.
So I want to say this is going to sound a little bit off, but it'll make sense, and I'll get to the point real fast. I was meeting Tim a few years ago in New York to do some. We were meeting various people in New York, Bitcoin related. This is 5 years ago, and so he had an office in the Freedom Tower on whatever the 80th floor. It was like this hoteling thing. So I get there and I said, "Oh, we're gonna meet with some clients there." And I said, "Hey, we need a room with a whiteboard." And the woman looked at me. She's like, what is this, like kindergarten? I'm like, kindergarten? I'm like, no, there's like a whiteboard and we have these dry erase markers in different color. And she goes, we don't have that at all. And I'm like, oh. I'm like, okay. She goes, we can get you an easel with like this flip paper on it. I'm like, okay. This is 4 years ago. This is not in the Freedom Tower. This is the tier A on 85th floor, whatever it is, a phenomenal view. In Silicon Valley, when you go for an interview, when you get through that stage, we have these whiteboards in all of these rooms. You go in there and you're talking to somebody and you're like, great, I read your resume. I want you to go over there on the whiteboard and diagram the packet walkthrough or the logical throughput of what this design is, because then I know how you think. I want you to draw and go diagram it on the whiteboard. That's it. Right there. Go do it. I'll shut up. Go do it. And it's amazing that in Silicon Valley, I will tell you that you'll typically get, because we, before they come in for the in-person interview, pretty much you can weed out those people. Usually 75% of the people are able to do that. If I had to do that anywhere else except for Silicon Valley, I would think that 98% of the people would fail. And so what you just said, Jeff, is create an Excel spreadsheet, create a yield curve, create all this stuff. The amount of people that can do that is like this big. And in Silicon Valley, you just go draw this all out. And this is how the business model is going to flow. And this is where our customers are, our TAMs. And we're able to draw all this. So I think that's my takeaway, is that as soon as you ask people to do this, and they don't teach that skill in school, from what I can tell.
Yeah. Now, if somebody writes math code, math is in short supply.
Well, it's math. It's just this thinking process. And I don't, you know, it's one of those things that I just don't know if the people that are teaching. And Mason, congratulations to you. You've done exactly. And the same thing with Dan and Jeff, you guys, the younger guys. Adrian, you're a little bit older than them, right? So you guys have, you jumped on an industry. For me, I jumped on the internet bubble in the 90s. That was the fastest growing industry in the 90s. Buddy said to me, he goes, I don't know what the internet is. Go figure it out. Still friends with him to this day. Very successful lawyer. That's what he said to me in 1998. And I was like, the internet? That's for downloading whatever. And anyway, so for me, that's what I did. But you guys embraced it. Jeff, you got a job in this, and this is where we are today. And that was the fastest growing space, right?
Yeah, it's fastest growing. It will be the fastest growing space for a while. Yeah.
It was. And by the way, for the old timers, if they don't know this, Apple almost went out of business. Microsoft bailed out Apple because everybody's like, why would Microsoft bail out Apple? Microsoft bailed out Apple. This is a decade before the iPhone, because if Apple would have went out of business, the thought process was the U.S. government would have broken up Microsoft because it would have a monopoly, even though it has a default, you know, a monopoly on just enterprise software. So Microsoft bailed out Apple. And then a decade later, Apple came out with the iPhone, right? So you have to think, and Steve Jobs left Apple. You should watch the movies on what happened back in the old days. Everything changed after the iPhone came out. And you guys are living in that generation now. It's not the access to information. It's the ability to figure out, what am I going to do with it?
Bingo.
I'll go on mute now.
All right. Well, we're on hour 18. I got to pack. I'm going to Abu Dhabi tomorrow. So to ask crack of dawn, I got a 24-hour day of flying, which is crazy. But I guess maybe final thoughts. I'm going to throw this out there and you guys can react to it as well. Vanguard's now allowing Bitcoin ETF, or Bitcoin and crypto, which is crazy. Bitcoin and crypto ETFs to be traded on their platform. That started on Monday. We've also seen the price of Bitcoin rise, which is pretty interesting. Interesting timing. And MSCI, I think there's going to be a time and place to make some noise about this. It looks like Saylor is going to be in conversation with MSCI here soon. And I encourage everybody to make some noise as we get into the end of the year on this MSCI topic. I think there will be some publications that we can rally behind, and it will be a good topic to put pressure on, Senate and House members and political members, and any pressure that we can apply through this group would be great as well. So that's kind of my final thought, and I'll pass it over to, let's say, Adrian. Final thoughts.
So with Vanguard, I mean, sooner or later they all bend the knee. So that was going to happen at one point or another. With MSCI, I got into Yahoo Finance, and you and I got into Bitcoin Magazine on our thoughts around MSCI. So I think that you're right that we can apply a lot of pressure with that, because their rationale doesn't really make any sense. It's clearly punitive, it's clearly retroactive, and it's clearly a discretionary, what I call part of a hit job on MSCR. So I think that that's going to be a very interesting conversation coming up in the next coming weeks, because they included strategy without issue in May 2024. Now, magically, JP Morgan is rattling the saber about delisting, and MSCI is coming around to it, which just doesn't make any sense, especially when you look into the fact of what is the impetus, really, when strategy trades over $1 trillion a year, and with all the other ETFs and associated products, we're at over almost close to $1.4 trillion. It's not a fund. It doesn't operate like a fund. And I think that that is a very, very nebulous stance to take, especially when you already included them and they've been in for almost a year already. So I'm interested to see where that goes.
Insurance companies are operating companies, and they are structured finance companies. That is quite literally what they do. They do structured finance, and they are considered operating companies. If you were to replace real estate with Bitcoin and say, oh, we're not going to include companies with real estate assets greater than 50%, that would just be an absolutely ludicrous statement. So the fact that you say you can't, like, you're just picking digital assets, or you're picking Bitcoin, a $2 trillion asset.
Especially after you already included them without any fanfare. You just included them. Remember, because we even talked about this last year. I did the article on it with the Russell 1000 and all that stuff. We went through what the weighting could look like and all that stuff. And now all of a sudden they're talking about delisting it because digital asset treasury. It just doesn't make any sense.
It's like the they let the Trojan horse in the gate. And then now they're like starting to realize it, and they're like, oh shit.
Well, that's what happened. The timeline is they Metaplanet announced their big buy, and that's when MSCI put out the first notice. And then everything kind of just cascaded from there. I think Mason's right. They realized what they kind of opened the door to, and now they're starting to say, oh. they should just make a whole new index is what they should do.
They should do MSCI X digital assets.
Sure.
If you want to buy that and not make it, you want to underperform the rest of the world, go for it. Right. Like, right on. Okay. Over to you, Dan. Final thoughts.
I think the next year is going to be really, really interesting. You got Larry Fink pumping this narrative that tokenization of assets is the internet circa 1996. So it's going to be interesting to see how Bitcoin as the money and the actual energy currency fits into whatever these boys concoct in terms of tokenized assets over the next year. So I'm really curious to see how that plays out.
Yeah, I saw that picture with Brian Armstrong. That was interesting.
Yeah, sure. I think people need to remember Bitcoin's the digital money. Everything else is something else.
Yeah, bingo. All right, over to Mason.
My first point is this is the most bullish I've heard Dan Hillary on MSTR, and maybe, I don't know, Dan, how many months has it
been? I mean, last time I was bullish, it was $110 a share and it went to 500. So.
Yeah. That's signal, folks. And he's bullish for good reason. I mean, I think we're getting to a apex of fear, of FUD, of misunderstanding, and the strength, ironically, it's never been better. Five preferreds, 650,000 Bitcoin, 1.4 billion in cash reserves. And I think the capital is coming. I think it might take, it's going to be gradual. It might take 5 to 10 years for it to play out, but that's why we're here. Like, it was never going to be easy. And I think if you're here right now watching after this insane volatility, you're not a tourist, and congratulations, and hold on tight.
Yeah, hold on tight. Yeah, Mason, I liked your post. You're at this point where it's like most polarizing, right? Like people were incredibly bullish, including myself and everybody on the screen, when the price is at 541,000 or 530, 540. And they had 275,000 Bitcoin, or like what was the number? It was like 275,000 Bitcoin.
It was 250. It was like 252 or something.
250. No prefs, and they had just launched, you know, the 2121 plan right after the earnings call, and it was one of these like, oh my god, scenarios, and the stock absolutely ripped on top of the presidential election. Obviously, 2025 has been just a damn whirlwind and a crab bear market that we've had to just endure here. But the math is good. Like, the math is really good. Like, the balance sheet itself is just so much stronger today than it was at that period of time. And you just sit back and you look at that, and like, to your point, like, we've reached max bearishness when the balance sheet is just so much stronger than it's ever been.
Yeah, I said a point of maximum asymmetry between strategies, price, sentiment, and fundamentals.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Asymmetry, for sure. All right, over to you, Green.
Yeah, look, it comes down to the debasement trade. So the Treasury, there was an announcement that came out today. They were trying to sell, whatever the number is, $12 billion worth of Treasuries, and it was triple oversubscribed. The Treasury can't sell it. But the Fed numbers come out tomorrow to see what happens with quantitative easing. So I believe that happens 4 or 5 p.m. East Coast time, and I will post about that. I did a tweet about this. Everybody can look this up. So this, it's fundamentally different this time, given that the second largest line item is the interest payments in the federal budget. It's interest. Only Social Security is higher. And so this time is they have to print. There's no way around this. And then we had some bad job numbers from ADP today. So what's going to happen, we'll see. We'll know tomorrow. And the first thing about the Treasury, because the Treasury is different than the Fed, but for the Treasury, the fact that there was triple the amount that wanted to sell to exchange out their treasuries on this means that there's stress in the system. So the Fed knows this in advance, right? And so what you're going to, tomorrow is going to be important. So if you're a big fan of Larry Lepard and Jeff Booth and Lynn Alden, nothing stops this train. I think that Bitcoin could catch on, and maybe you should get some. That's it. And Jeff, have a great trip in Abu Dhabi.
Yeah. Going to the Middle East, going to the desert. Yeah, it should be a good time. Bitcoin Mena, first time out there.
I'll be there too.
And Mason same, will be there. Same if you're Mason, there, yes. I think if you're at Bitcoin Mena for whatever reason, we are going to have a happy hour at some point. Stay tuned. Take a look at my profile. We'll announce something. It might be on the Strive page. I think myself, Ben, and Matt Cole will all be there from the Strive team, and would love to chat digital credit and everything that's going on. So don't be shy.
Yeah, I was supposed right to be on. There, but I had to cancel my trip because of all my stuff, so. I hope you guys have fun.
Adrian's working hard, always. All right, thanks everybody. We're at an hour and 27. Of course, we did not stay under an hour. We tried, kind of, and we just let it roll. We were having a great conversation. So thank you everybody for the time. We will keep cooking. I do not think we will. Actually, no, we'll be on next week. I think Dan is leading the stream next week because he will be stateside. And
you guys are going to get punished.
Feel free to join next week.
You guys are going to get punished with the charts.
Punish them. Yeah. Punish them with the charts. All right. All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll catch you next week.